Amen. We are on holy ground with this book in this Bible talking about the theme that we're talking about, the topics that we're talking about. It is a sacred and beautiful and holy thing. It'll be fun too, right? It'll be fun. We're gonna have fun and we're gonna laugh. At times, I already know that I cannot teach a series of sermons on sexual intimacy and not accidentally say hundreds of words that end up as innuendos, and we all chuckle like 13-year-old boys, right? Or maybe I just will. I don't know. That's going to happen. We're going to have fun. This is going to be fun, but at the same time, this is just a holy thing that we're doing, where we're talking about sacred things, the things of God, the deep things of God, where he has given us gifts and beauty and pleasure and desire and delight and ecstasy. He's given us these great gifts, and we know that they point to something even greater, something greater that we don't even understand. Right? How are you to understand at your right hand, God, our pleasures forevermore? How do we even grasp what that's going to mean, that in the presence of God for all eternity, our pleasures forevermore? All I know is we get marriage and sex for maybe, what, 60 years? And then it's gone. The new heavens, the new earth, there's no marriage, there's no intimacy. It's pointing to something even better, and I don't even know what it is. I don't even know how to describe it. That's a weighty, holy, sacred, beautiful thing that we're talking about. This is a holy thing that we're dealing with here. We're talking about friendship and union and two becoming one and the mystery of that. And we're talking about conflict and communication and relationship. These are things that the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus speak into. This is a holy thing. We're talking about sexual brokenness and marriage issues that some of you are going through, or things like that, things that only the gospel can heal. That's a holy thing. So this is going to be fun. We're going to have fun. We're going to laugh. This is going to be a delight to listen to how God has designed marriage and sex. It's going to be beautiful, but it's a holy and sacred thing as well, and I just want us to make sure that we consider that. Now, there's a couple of things that I need us to know going into the song as a whole. So kind of just a brief intro of the book that'll just help orient us to what's happening in what we're reading over the next few months. Here's the first thing, unbelievably important. This is a song and not a story. Okay, we're going to talk more about this later, but this is a song and not a story. Solomon wrote it, but he didn't write it about any particular husband or particular wife. It's about any wife or any husband. This is a song that invites you and me into the music that we might sing it to. Husbands, we should be able to sing like he sings. Wives, you should be able to sing like she sings. This isn't just somebody's story. It's not somebody's story at all. It's our story. All right, it's our song that we can be a part of. And so this is God's song to us, a gift to us to embrace godly romance in a marriage, okay? So this isn't just story. It's like, oh, that's cool for them. No, this is for you. This is for you. Imagine with me a church filled with marriages that are being restored by the gospel. Imagine with me a people, single or married, that are being healed in their sexual brokenness and intimacy issues. Like, that's happening, and together we're singing a song. Can you imagine what our friends and family would hear of the grace and mercy of God? How much they would want to hear more of God's love to us if this was our testimony. This is our song. We can sing this too. And so as we get into it, man, this isn't somebody's story. This is your story. This is God's gift to you. This can be for you, okay? Here's the second thing. This is a big deal as well, and it should be obvious if you know anything about the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon. You can call it either one. But it's very open about sexual intimacy. Okay? It's just very open about sexual intimacy. This would be a song that would be sung at the 7-day marriage celebration. Okay, so they partied way better than we did. It wasn't just one night. It was 7 days. And what would happen is the bride and the groom on the first night would go into their tent. Everybody knew what was going to happen, right? And then that morning they would walk out of their tent. Everybody knew what happened. And as soon as they walked out of the tent, the singer would start, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine." The wine would be poured, the music would start, and the party would keep going. It would do 7 days, 7 nights of that. And so the marriage, sexual intimacy was celebrated in public. It was sung about in the context of this wedding party. It wasn't hush-hush. It wasn't kind of put into the corner and not talked about. We have to be able to talk about these things. We have to recapture the sex narrative from the world and tell a better story about a God who gives us these great gifts of relationship and pleasure and covenant and joy and all of those things. So we're going to talk openly about sexual intimacy. There'll be maybe a few weeks where your 10-year-old or your 11-year-old, you may choose to prayerfully consider maybe not having him or her here. That's up to you. Those weeks are, you can go to our blog and see which weeks we would suggest you consider that. Not telling you to do it, just to consider that. But this isn't going to be like a high school locker room. We're gonna stick to the poetry and the song and the romance of how God speaks about these beautiful things that he talks about and that he has given us. But we're not going to be hush-hush about it either, okay? And then thirdly, this is a book, a song that's about Jesus, okay? So it's not about Jesus in some of the ways in which people have allegorized the song, and instead of seeing it as a husband and a wife and their sexual intimacy and romance between them, they just completely removed that idea, and they said, no, this is just Jesus and his bride, the church. And they've just allegorized everything in the song. It has nothing to do with sex. It has nothing to do with marriage. It has everything to do with your relationship with God. So pastors, commentators, theologians, for about a few hundred years did this. They're more influenced by Plato and the Greeks instead of just a clear, plain reading of what the Bible says. So they interpreted, as they read this, absolute absurdities into this book of the Bible. And these are like heroes of mine. I read their books. I love them. They just got this one wrong. I'll give you some examples. One guy took chapter 1, verse 12 in Song of Solomon, where it says the king is on his couch, and they said, that's Jesus in Mary's womb, okay? The king on the couch is Jesus in Mary's womb. I have no idea how he got there. Then in the next verse, this is worse, he says the sachet of myrrh that lies between the wife's breasts, that's Jesus between the two commandments to love God and love others. Okay? That's what that means. And then another guy's like, no, that's crazy. No, it's Jesus lying between the Old and New Testament. That's what's happening there. Right? So just kind of absurdities of how you would read into this book when we do that. When we say that this whole book and this whole song is about Jesus, what we mean is it's about Jesus and that the whole Bible is about Jesus. Right? The whole Bible is about Jesus. Jesus said, the whole Bible is about me. Everything points to me. Everything is fulfilled in me. And so we're not going to allegorize the song, but when it does point us to the love that he has for his bride, the church, then we're going to continually point to that, and it'll do that throughout the song. And so this song is about Jesus. This is going to be a gospel series, a gospel sermon. We can't read and teach the Song of Songs as if Jesus didn't live, die, and rise again and purchase us for himself and make us his own. We can't properly teach it or understand it without that understanding. So this is about Jesus, and so we'll talk about Jesus as well. Okay, so it's a song about sexual intimacy in the context of marriage, and that points us to God's love for his bride, the church. Okay, so that's how we're going to read the song. And so let's look at chapter 1, verse 1, and we're just going to look at verse 1 and chat some more, because it's going to give us some more time to talk about the song before we actually get into the singing of the song. So chapter 1, starting in verse 1. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. There is some debate over who wrote this, though it's not super compelling to me. The plainest, easiest reading of this is that Solomon wrote this song, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. 1 Kings 4 tells us that God gave Solomon great wisdom, wisdom that surpassed anyone else, and that he penned 3,000 proverbs and 1,005 songs. We know the exact number of songs that Solomon wrote. And just like his dad, King David, he was a songwriter. He wrote 1,005 of them, and this is apparently the greatest song. In the Hebrew language, there's no word for a superlative. So you don't have the greatest king, but you have the King of Kings. Right? You have the Lord of Lords. You have the Holy of Holies. And so you have the Song of Songs. This is the greatest song, and it has to be the greatest song because it's a love song. The love song has to be the greatest song, right? The Song of Songs anticipates the Apostle Paul later in the New Testament saying, the greatest of these is love. And so the greatest song is a love song. And because it's a song, because it's a love song, and because it's a love song in the Bible, it has to stir up in us a divine love, right? It has to make us think about God's love for us. Peter Kreef, the great philosopher, he said, God is love, and music is the language of love. Therefore, music is the language of God. Music is the language of God. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, in their writings, they imagine that creation was God singing things into existence, that the language of let there be light was in music. The first recorded words that we have for humanity is Adam singing to his wife Eve, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. You are called woman because you are taken out of man. This at last is woman. Right? He sings to her. Right? Maybe singing in church isn't weird. Maybe it's weird that we don't sing everywhere else. Right? Maybe heaven will be just one big musical. Maybe Hamilton's popularity is because it's singing somehow to our ancient soul, and we used to sing, and now we just talk. Right? How boring that is. I just can't imagine that. How is singing heaven when it's not heaven when I sing now? It just sounds really, really bad. But maybe somehow that's a product of sin, and we'll all sing really good when we get to heaven, right? We'll all just, it'll be a delight to everyone's ears. I don't know, but there's this sense in which music is this language of love and this language of God. Here's what we do know. We know that Jesus sang. Jesus sang a hymn with his disciples at the Last Supper. In Hebrews 2, it talks about Jesus singing in the midst of the congregation. So men, singing at church is a godly, manly thing to do because the manliest man who ever walked the earth sang at church, and he was probably singing a psalm that was written by King David, who killed tens of thousands of people in war and wrote songs, right? So it's manly and godly to sing boldly and loudly. And then in Romans 15:9, Jesus is pictured as a worship leader. Did you know that? Jesus is our worship leader, where he's leading us in song, and he's even playing an instrument, if you go back to the Psalms that it's quoting out of. And so Jesus sings, we're to sing. In fact, God sings over us. One of my favorite verses in all of the Bible, Zephaniah 3:17. It says this, the Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one, who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will quiet you by his love, and he will exalt over you with loud singing. God sings over us. And so we have to consider throughout our time in the Song of Songs that this is a song. It's poetry. It's meant to do something in us. And it's just different, right? Songs and poetry is just different, right? We could say, we could quote Lord Byron. He says this, she walks in beauty like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes, thus mellowed to that tender light which heaven to gaudy day denies. And that just sounds different than merely saying a woman in a black dress with dark eyes looked pretty when she walked past me. It just evokes something different in us, right? We could say, hey, I really wish that you didn't get married to that person. And they could say, well, if you didn't want me to get married to that person, then you should have married me. Or we could sing with the great theologian Beyonce and say, because if you liked it, then you should have put a ring on it. If you liked it, then you should have put a ring on it. Oh, 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 oh. right? That evokes something different in us, right? I could say, hey, marriages, you should love one another and commit to one another in that love. And that would be right, and that would be true. Or we could sing, like the Song of Songs says in chapter 8, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. That's just different. It evokes a mood. It's meant to spark a fire. It's meant to stir in you emotion. And if I just say husbands and wives commit to one another in a boring reformed preacher's voice, then we're going to miss what Song of Solomon chapter 8 is saying. And so we've got to enter into the song, the poetry of it. We need to feel it and smell it and touch it and taste it. I need you to try to do that as we walk through this over the next few months. I don't know that I'm able to be able to evoke that in you well. We're going to need to partner together to let this sing in our hearts before we just try to apply it in our lives. It's meant to stir in us something. This is God's song for us, for love, and for romance. It's not a manual or a how-to on sex, right? This isn't going to be about techniques. This isn't five ways to better please your lover. That's not what this is. It's a song. Let it sing. It's going to be practical. But let it stir in you something. Let it be healing to you. This is God's song to us for love and marriage, okay? All right, here's the song. Here's the first part of it. It starts with a bang. Verse 2, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. What a great way to start a book of the Bible off, right? Verse 3, your anointing oils are fragrant. He's got good cologne on. He's not wearing Axe body spray. This is legit stuff. Your name is oil poured out. Therefore, virgins love you. Draw me after you. Let us run. The king has brought me into his chambers. Now the bridesmaids are going to sing. The choir is going to sing. We will exalt and rejoice in you. We approve of this. We extolled your love more than wine. And then I think she's singing here. In the ESV, it has the choir still singing, but I think this is her, the bride. She says, rightly do they love you. What is the poetry doing here? What does the song sound like here? Let's just try to feel some of this. What do you feel when you see this? What do you see? Notice that the bride, she is singing first, right? She sings first. As we get into it, you'll see that she sings the most. The woman here is not silent or shy. She is not passive or weak. She takes the initiative here in the song. She's expressing passion and desire, and her desires are godly. Right? She takes the initiative here, but her initiation is an invitation. Did you notice that? Right? She doesn't kiss him. She says, let him kiss me. I want you to kiss me. She doesn't kiss him. She invites him to kiss her, right? She's not looking to dominate. She's looking to invite. She wants him to kiss him. She's leading him to kiss him. She wants him to lead, but she leads him to lead. It's beautiful. And the language here in the Hebrew of let him kiss me with the kisses of mouth, this is not a peck on the cheek, right? This is deep, intense, and intimate, and probably doesn't stay at the lips. That's what the commentators are telling me, okay? This is a deep and passionate kiss that she desires, and she wants this kiss because for your love is better than wine. This is the Hebrew word dod, and dod means erotic love. This isn't steadfast love or friendship love or sacrificial love. This is passionate love. Your passionate love is better than wine, so kiss me. Kiss me. And so his love for her is better than wine. Her love for him, it's better than wine. In the Bible, wine is seen as a good thing. In the Bible, it's seen as symbolic for joy and for blessing. The psalmist will say that God gave us wine to gladden our hearts. Jesus' first miracle was to make really, really, really good wine at a wedding where this song was probably being sung. He's like, oh, your love is better than wine. Let me see if I can do something about that. Right? He just made really good wine. That was his first miracle. Jesus, he incorporates wine into this kind of tangible picture of the gospel along with the bread. And so every Sunday when we gather, we partake in a love feast of wine and bread as we remember the love of God that has rescued us. Right? Wine is seen as a beautiful thing, as a good thing. It's a good thing in the Bible. And she says, yeah, but love is better. Your love is better than even wine. She's basically saying, make me drunk with your love and kisses. I want to be drunk in your love. Song of Solomon, Solomon said the same thing in the book of Proverbs in chapter 5. He says, let your fountain be blessed. Rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breast fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love. Be drunk in her love. And then in verse 4, she invites him again, draw me after you. She says, let us run. She wants him right now. And then she calls him king. The king has taken me into his chambers. Those that would allegorize the poem, what they say here is that this is actually God inviting the Israelites out of slavery into Egypt and into the promised land. That's what's happening here. That's not what's happening here. Right? This is a woman, a wife, who desires her husband. She wants him to run with her to the bedroom, and she calls him the king. Now, this isn't Solomon writing about one of his relationships. This isn't Solomon and his bride. This is every man, every woman. So when she says king here, she doesn't mean he's an actual king. Later, she'll call him a shepherd. What she's saying here, and a lot of wedding traditions have carried this, and some traditions, the wife or the bride at a wedding is considered a queen, and the groom is considered a king and is even crowned, right? She's his queen, and he is her king. That's what she's saying. You're my king. She's basically saying, you're a stud, and my man has taken me into his room. That's what she's saying here in verse 4. And then the last thing I want you to try to feel in the poetry and the song is just the growing intimacy that happens in these short, just few verses. She starts off saying, let him kiss me, right? He's over there. Let him, I want him to kiss me, right? And then it changes to, for your love is better than wine. Now it's not him, it's your. Your love is better than wine. You got some good cologne on. Your name is like oil, right? Then it moves to you, him, your, you. Therefore, virgins love you. Draw me after you. And then it ends with, let us run. It's as if he's getting closer and closer and closer, and it moves from him to us. The two have now become one. There's a drawing near, a closer and closer intimacy as they continue to sing. And so this is passion and attraction and union and delight and pleasure and joy wrapped up in just three verses. We're not even close to being done. Right? There's a gospel freedom in her song. And so, wives, or even just women in general, even men, even husbands, this could be you. But some of you, even in these short few verses, can maybe feel some sort of shame or just discouragement. I don't have these desires. I don't have this kind of freedom. What are you trying to tell me, Pastor? I bet she doesn't have a bunch of young kids hanging around her all the time. And we can feel discouraged, we can feel ashamed, because maybe this isn't something we have in our marriage, or this is something that we can't expect to see in our marriage, or there's just something broken. I'm going to address those kinds of things even a little bit today and as we go, but here's what I want us to do first. Will you just let this song sing to you first? Like, before you go to that place, will you trust the song that God is singing about his gift to you in regards to marriage and intimacy? Would you let that be what you believe more than the accusations of the enemy or even the insecurities that would pop up in our heart or be exposed? Would you just believe in the song that God has given us more so than those things right now? Here's what's not happening in this book of the Bible that God has given you. God is not putting a weight on you in your marriage that because maybe there's some brokenness or some issues that you're too weak to hold up and it's going to crush you. If that's what you're feeling, even in these short first few verses, then let me encourage you. That's not what he's doing. He's not saying, look, this is how it's supposed to be. Figure it out. No. He's singing to you a song of what can be. He's wanting whatever is exposed in your heart. He's wanting this song to heal you in that. He's wanting to bring healing to you in that. This isn't meant to be a weight that you bear that you can't hold up. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, look, this is my gift to you. Oh, you're broken? That's okay. That's what I do. I fix broken things. I'm the God who fixes broken things. I'm the God who restores things that are torn. That's what I do. No. See this as a song of healing that I have for you. Okay? Let's just let this song sing to us before we go to some of those places. Now, what does the first part of this song tell us? Right, we try to feel a little bit of it. What are some things that it shows us about marriage and intimacy? Here's the first thing. It tells us that sexual desire is holy. That sexual desire is godly. It's a good thing. Too much in the church, what we've been taught is been influenced by Plato and the Greeks, and that somehow there's this sacred secular divide and kissing isn't sacred. That's what we, right? The physical isn't nearly as important as the spiritual. Right, the material isn't as important as the immaterial, completely forgetting that our God created all that is material, that our God created the body and everything in it and said that it was all what? Good. Right? It's all good. Forgetting completely that the very gospel message speaks of the importance of the physical and the material. God came in the flesh. Right, he entered actually into human history and he lived and he died. And when he rose again, he rose in bodily form. Right? We forget that our God right now is fully God, fully man, sits on his throne in a body. Jesus right now is in a body. The physical matters, the body matters. And when we try to separate physical from spiritual as if somehow one is more important than the other, then we're entering into some foolishness and some wrong thinking. And it's one thing to do the absurd thing where we take, you know, the woman's breasts and turn them into the Old and New Testaments. That's absurd. But if we're not careful and we begin to call evil or bad what God calls good, we're entering into heresy. That's a big deal, right? Desire is good. Desire is godly. Sometimes some of you grew up in that church, right, where it just was taught that sex is dirty and wrong. So save it for the one you love. Oh, okay. That's interesting. You were taught that, right? Right? It's like we think God creates Adam and Eve, turns around to go get another star or something, turns back and is surprised at what they're doing. What? What do they do? Jesus, Holy Spirit, I thought you were keeping an eye on these two. What's going on? No, he created it. He created it. Right? He rejoiced in it and he said, this is good. This is good. Desire is good. Desire is godly. We've got to see that in here. Let this song be healing to you. Let it be healing to you. And so if there isn't desire then for the husband, or it isn't desire for the wife, if there's a lack of desire in your marriage or relationship, what that means then is something is broken. Well, let's just recognize that. Let's just confess that. If sexual desire is good and godly, then that means if there's a lack of it, if there's something going on, then something's broken. Maybe the relationship is broken. Right? Maybe something in the marriage is broken. Maybe there's something broken in you. Right? The marriage bed is an outpouring of what's happening already in the marriage relationship. And so if there's a lack of friendship, if there's conflict, if there's sin, then that's going to affect the intimacy in the bedroom. It just is, right? It just is. And so we've got to address then the brokenness of the marriage before we can even expect for healing to happen in the marriage bed. Or if you're broken, right? Sexual sin in the past, sexual abuse, bad teaching on sex that you grew up with, something else, there's shame, there's guilt, there's something like that to where you're broken. Well, then there's got to be something that's healed there before we can expect the sexual desire in marriage to begin to grow and be healed as well. If that's you, then let the passionate love of this husband and the passionate desires of this wife, will you just let that expose the brokenness in you? Here's going to be your temptation to grow hard-hearted, to push this down, to not like something that I say, because there's a brokenness in you and you feel like you can't live up to some book. You're not meant to live up to some book. This book is meant to speak to your heart and bring healing. As we read this and hear this song, if some of that brokenness in you because of sexual abuse or sexual sin or whatever it is, let that expose the brokenness in your heart and let God sing this over you as a place of a thing of healing. Let it bring about healing in your heart. Don't embrace, or rather don't ignore the brokenness that we might have if we have a lack of desire. In fact, I want you to start tonight just by reading through Psalm 55, 56, or 57. I want you to read it. I want you to resonate with the emotions that David has. Feel what he feels. And then I want you to pray like he does. Pray like he does. And then I want you to believe that how God acts in David's life, how God responds to the brokenness that David is feeling, or the suffering or abuse or the enemy that David is facing, that he will act in your life in the same way. Right? You have counted all my tears. You put them in your bottle. This I know, that God is for me. Believe those things when you read them. Right? That's how God acts on your behalf. Embrace the brokenness in your heart, and let's... And I'm really hopeful about the desires and intimacy that will grow in us as a people. The other thing that we learn from this part of the song is what should attract us to our spouse or future spouse. Typically, what attracts us is physical attraction first, right? And the song will actually sing of that soon. There's nothing wrong with physical attraction, but what's talked about here in these first few verses in the first part of the song is not physical attraction, but actually an attraction that's based on his name, right? The woman's friends love him, approve of him because of his name. She says in verse 3, "Your name is oil poured out." Of someone's name is someone's character, right? His character is a pleasing fragrance to her. That's what she's saying. In the Bible, God's name is referring to God's character. It's his the essence of who he is. It's the makeup of who God is. That's his name. And so we'll say things like, you know, those who know your name will put their trust in you. And if you know the name of our God, you will trust him. If you know what he's like, you'll trust him. Or some trust in chariots and some trust in horses, but we're going to trust in the name of our God. Or Psalm 29:2, it'll say this, "Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name." Right? His character, who he is, makes us glorify him. Worship the Lord in the splendor or the beauty of his holiness. Right? God's holiness, his character, his name is what makes him beautiful to us. Right, so it's a turn on for her, his character, what he's like. Wives, what delights you the most about your husband? What he looks like or how he treats you? This is a godly man that she's attracted to and wants in a sexual way because of his character, because of his name. Men, you want a godly woman. Single men in particular, you need a godly woman. The husband in Proverbs 31, he delights in his wife because of her character. It says in verse 30, "Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised." See, what matters most in marriage, which then means that what matters most in the marriage bed, is not how they look and not the personality or not the sense of humor, though those are good things, and we should have the, like we can want those things and have that kind of chemistry. Nothing wrong with that, but what matters most is character. You know, it's interesting, in most other, in pretty much every one of our other relationships, we're not considering the looks first, right? You're not friends with who you're friends with because of what they look like. You like them because of how they treat you and their character. Your favorite teacher growing up wasn't your favorite teacher, I don't think, guys, because she was hot, right? But because of how they treated you and how they taught you and all of that. Your childhood wasn't a good childhood because of how your parents looked, but because how they treated you and how they raised you. Character is what matters most in relationship. That's what matters most in relationship. And a godly character is sexy because the real stuff of life can't be held up by good looks or a good personality. You want an actual real relationship with somebody, marriage relationship with somebody. What matters most in life when things get hard or when we have to navigate stormy waters or where there's conflict is, man, is he going to be gentle to me in this? Is she going to be kind to me as we walk through this? How gracious is he? What is he like when things are stressful and hard? That's what's going to matter more than what does she look like? What does he look like? Character is what should attract us to one another the most. Do they lead me more to Jesus? Do they exhibit the fruit of the Spirit? Marriage conferences and marriage books are great and they're perfectly fine. I don't think my wife has ever read a marriage book. But here's what she's done. She reads her Bible, she prays, she repents of sin, and she worships in joy even when it's hard, even when life is hard. And through that, over the years, the Holy Spirit has made her look more and more like Jesus, and her character is beautiful to me. It's beautiful to me. We met in a bar. You like that transition? We met in a bar. We didn't actually meet in the bar because we didn't say anything to each other. We just looked at each other, and that's all it took. Right? She didn't have me at hello. We just had each other at, wow, I like how you look. We didn't actually even talk or meet at the bar, but then we ran into each other the next day, and we began to talk, and the first couple of years of our relationship was really, really hard because we looked good, but God had to do a lot in our character. Right? He had to do a lot of work in our hearts that we might look more and more like Jesus. And now at 38, I don't look like I did at 22. All right? I just don't. She does. She looks exactly the same. Right, just for the record, looks exactly the same, but what attracts us to one another is what the Lord has done in our name. Right? Our character, our godliness is what's most beautiful. Right, the looks will go, and they will go quickly, right? Quickly. Not for her, but for me. But a name, man, a name, characters, that's a godly and sexy thing, and it's what should attract us to one another. So, if desire is lacking in your marriage, or maybe you just want to grow in this, okay? Maybe you just want to grow in this. But if desire is lacking, if there's some things that need to be worked on here, I want you to consider these three things as we close up. The first, I want you to pray. Honestly, I don't know that there's a more important thing for you to do if there's desire or intimacy or attraction lacking in your relationship. Pray. Ask God to light a fire in your bed. Ask God to light a fire in your marriage. But don't do the sacred secular divide thing where somehow you put sex over here and your relationship with God over here as if he doesn't somehow care or speak into that. No. Pray. Pray specifically. Pray boldly. Pray in such a way that it might be rude if you told me what your prayers were. And I want you to pray. Right? I want you to pray like they talk to each other. Like they talk to each other in this, you pray. You pray for specific things regarding intimacy. I can't even tell you the things I pray for in my marriage. pray boldly that God would light a fire in you, that you guys would grow and grow and grow. In fact, all of us need to grow. You think your relationship's good, man, you're still in that honeymoon phase. You don't know anything until we get into, look at chapter 2, 3, 4, 5, just start reading. You're not there yet. Pray that he would light a flame of fire, of passion in your bedroom. Fast and pray. Man, if something's really broken, will you fast and pray that there'd be desire for your husband, desire for your spouse, that they would have a desire for you if maybe that's lacking, but let's pray. Second thing, huge, work on your character, not on your marriage. I got a chance to spend time last year with the best counselor in the world. That's not just a recommendation. He's literally one of the best counselors in the world. And it was part of this pastor's thing that I was a part of. We call him the soul ninja, okay? This guy just makes you cry. It's really horrible. And here's what he said about marriages. He said, I've never had a husband and a wife come to me for counseling where they didn't think that if the other person changed, the marriage would be better. That the reason why the marriage was broken was because the other person. He said that's always the case. Nobody ever thinks it's actually them. That the problem is actually them. The problem is you. Work on your character, not on your marriage. Right? The Christian life is first between you and God, not you and someone else or you and your spouse. Right, we live our life coram Deo before the face of God. What needs to change in your character? Where does the grace of God need to press into something in your life and change you and make you look more and more like Jesus? What needs to change in you? Spouses, tonight I want you to ask a hard question of your husband or your wife. Right? Where in my life does the grace and mercy of God need to press in and bring about change? What can I work on that would make me more attractive? I want you to ask that hard question. Friends, or rather singles, I want you to ask that question of a friend. What needs to change in my character? What do I need to pray about? What do I need to ask God to do a good work, to mature me or grow me in? What needs to change in me? Look for a growth in character, not in a growth in your marriage. And then finally, third, pursue a greater desire of Jesus. Do you desire God? Desiring God is attractive. What your spouse needs the most from you is that you would pursue a love of Jesus more and more. What will do more things in your marriage is that you would love God more and more. Do you? Do you desire Jesus? Right, this is just all over the Bible, this idea. Right, David in the Psalms, Psalm 63, O God, you are my God, earnestly I seek you. Right, we read it before, ascribe to the Lord, a glory do his name, worship him in the splendor of holiness. Psalm 96:6, splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. One thing that I ask, there's one thing that I want to do, is spend all the days of my life in the presence of God. You desire him. Do you pursue a love of Jesus? Do you desire Jesus? The God's beauty is wrapped up in his holiness. It's in his name. Right? We desire God. We love God because of who he is, his character, how he treats us. What he's like produces in us a desire for him. And we joked about this a couple of weeks ago, about, you know, how demons believe in God. Satan has right thinking about God. Satan has, in some sense, a right theology, a better theology than you or I even do. He thinks more thoughts about God in one day than you or I do in a year. Satan thinks about God rightly, but it doesn't delight the heart of God. It doesn't matter. It doesn't glorify Jesus that he has right thinking about God. There's no desire. There's no worship in him. It's the desire, the worship, the glory that matters. That when we express and delight in the heart of God, the name of God, that's what brings Jesus glory. That's what we were made for. Right? That's why you can not be married and still have a life fulfilled, because ultimately life isn't about sex and desire and marriage. Ultimately, life is about desiring God. Do you desire God? Desiring God is attractive, and we can because Jesus first desired us. The relational fire between you and God starts with him singing over you. But sometimes we could just get into right thinking and right theology and we don't hear his voice. We love because he first loved us. Do you really believe that? Do you really believe that God loves you or God just loves? Does he delight in you? Does he desire you? The gospel answer is yes. Do you desire him? It's meant to evoke in you, stir in you, a desire for God. God loves you, and that love for you wasn't meant to produce in you just right thinking about him, but right emotions about him, a right desire towards him. Do you love God? And the more that we experience that God who loves us in that way will be to the degree that you can love your spouse with that kind of love, even if there's a lack of desire there. Right? That kind of love is healing. It's restoring, and it's beautiful. How great is this God that he would love us in this way? That he would give us this song.